Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
And welcome to the AEW Dynamite Review. I'm Adam Wilborn from What Culture, joined by the Dadley Boys of What Culture, Michael Hamflett and Michael Sidgwick, here to review everything that happened on last night's episode of AEW Dynamite Fighter Fest Night 2. But before we get into it, if you're a fan of this sort of thing, make sure you subscribe to What Culture Wrestling on either iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts from, for daily wrestling podcasts, where we not only review AEW Dynamite, but also Raw, SmackDown, NXT, pay-per-views. We have interviews, roundtable discussions, and a roundup of the week, complete with a bloody good quiz, of course, on WrestleCulture. As I said, though, joined by Hamflett and Sidgwick to review AEW Dynamite. And how did Night 2 of Fighter Fest feel for you, Michael Sidgwick?
Here's the thing about this product and where it stands right now. I was in dreamland after what was an uneven show. The rumours ahead of the show itself helped place me in that mood. An absolutely incredible finish put me in that mood. But I think what brought it all home to me, and there were elements of this show that I was just pretty bored and disenchanted by, if I'm being honest. And yet, if I'd had one prevailing bad thought, I've had quite a few bad thoughts about AEW this year, in truth. Interferences, them dogging it during the Saturday, Friday night era for the most part. But my one prevailing nagging issue was like, oh, this company isn't totally perfect, because usually they can rebound from bad, apathetic Friday night Dynamite show, and it's broadly excellent. But, you know, the fact that they've bungled Lance Archer means that this is all a bit temporary. He's the one symbol of the fact that they can't do this well for an infinite amount of time. And he's back, totally reheated, incredible main event, looks like a total superstar. I mean, what can this company do that's wrong at this point? Like, Archer feels like 2020 Archer again.
Yeah, I watched the show live last night.
Of course.
Of course, and I feel no regrets about it. This is the thing. I thought a lot of it was rubbish. More of it was rubbish than good, actually. And I had a blast, and I didn't care. And I was trying to reconcile that during the main event that I was probably the low guy on, but I still enjoyed it enough. And it's just hot product trumps hot show any day of the week. Like, every wrestling company in the world is capable every now and then of running a hot show, because you can hotshot things, or you can just present something that works on the night and then doesn't have any longevity or anything like that. This wasn't a hot show in and of itself. It was a hot company with its hot product having a slightly off night and the last bit not really mattering. I don't think any of the in-ring particularly excelled all night. I didn't care. I don't think any of the promos, there's probably one that I'm forgetting, any of the promos were the best of their kind, the best of these wrestlers that we're used to, and it didn't matter. Like, the energy was amazing. The card they've put together for next week is unbelievable. And the show wasn't so bad that you didn't have faith that next week's card won't be unbelievable, you know? On fire. And we'll be finding other windows to talk about this thing, but I find it hard to believe that the announcement of potentially Daniel Bryan 5 minutes before Dynamite went on the air and CM Punk about 6 hours before Dynamite on the air doesn't feel like an accident. And that's like smart. That's not me being cynical. That's really, really smart. If what we're hearing it at very specific times for very specific reasons. Cool. Like, they're thinking about things, and it's all just, there's such a goddamn buzz around this company. And that was the prevailing thought through this entire episode of Dynamite, regardless of what was actually happening on the show.
I realise that this show is an hour shorter than Monday Night Raw, but we're going to be talking a lot about what happened on this episode. But before we do that, Sidge, Like, you talk about the sort of wave of momentum. Obviously, they've had road rages. They've had Fyter Fest Night 1, Fyter Fest Night 2. They've got Fight for the Fallen coming. They've got Homecoming the week after that. Then they've got the debut of Rampage either the week or 2 weeks after that. And then you've got all this rumours and expectation about Punk, about Brian. You've got All Out at the start of September. You've got the Arthur Ashe show, of course. It's a great time to be an AEW fan, isn't it?
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. And I don't know, like, the numbers back this up. I think it was last week that AEW Dynamite beat Raw in male 18 to 49, which is absolutely huge. But like, there's this romantic notion that between not only how great Dynamite is in itself, these teasers and the reality of this wonderful, like, opened up pro wrestling world and the Forbidden Door, it just feels like if that goddamn Delta variant can be suppressed, yeah, this is proper golden age stuff.
Yeah. One final question before we dive into it. What's got two thumbs, speaks French, and his minute wrestling predictions? Moi. Right, let's start with Chris Jericho versus Sean. I'm just really, really in a good mood today, as you can probably tell. Ruined the AEW Dynamite review 5 minutes in from Michael Sidgwick. Anyway, let's talk about the first labour of Jericho. The show opened with Chris Jericho versus Sean Spears, with the chairman being allowed to use a chair, but Chris Jericho not being allowed. And they brawled all over the place at the start. Jericho hoists him to the outside, whips him into the barricade, does the cameraman spot, and everyone pops and loves a bit of that. But Spears equalizes it because, yeah, as I said, he's allowed to use a chair and Chris Jericho's not. He gets one from under the ring. He brought one in, but Chris Jericho jumped him straight away. Cut off a Chris Jericho springboard with it, targeted the injured left arm of Chris Jericho. Later on, he props Spears up in the corner, the old 10 punches and a top rope Frankensteiner. But then he runs into a thrust kick from Spears for a two count. This time, Spears makes the most of the stipulation, gets another chair, bashes it on his back, goes to hit it over his head, but Jericho takes him down, puts him in the Walls of Jericho. Spears fights to reach the ropes, but Jericho drags him back into the center ring. Looks like he's going to submit, but of course, Tully Blanchard distracts the official. He doesn't see the submission. Out comes Sammy Guevara and backs up Tully, sends him packing. Spears grabs a chair whilst he's still in the Walls, twats Chris Jericho with it, hits the C4. No one has kicked out of the C4. Well, now they have. Chris Jericho kicks out. Spears looks to set up a chair-assisted C4, but Jericho gets out of it, hits the Judas Effect. 1, 2, 3. We'll divvy this up into a two-parter for obvious reasons, Sidge. We'll talk about what happened after this in a sec, but what did you think of the match itself?
I thought it was really good. Obviously elevated by a crowd that was just completely and totally, hopelessly, in fact, in love with Chris Jericho. They almost loved him so much that they burnt themselves out for the next 30 minutes or something like that. I mean, I don't think the match that followed was particularly great, but there was definitely an exhausted vibe around the arena. Once this finished, the crowd were white hot for Jericho. And I thought this was without being a blow away awesome match, it was just a tremendous bit of business by a master and someone who's finally realizing their value and this reputation that they've not really shown on TV yet as someone who knows what the goddamn hell they're doing. I thought this was arranged so nicely. What I really liked about it, beyond MGF's absolutely cracking line about labor. Did you catch that?
Yes, I forgot to mention that.
So funny. Like, I've said it all along. I do a fat joke every single week. It'll pop me daft because I've got a dark sense of humor, but it was legitimately really funny. What I like most about this in terms of the premise and how they executed it is that it wasn't like condescending or patronizing at all. And I'm in admiration as well. I know I'm trying not to skip ahead here, but of how they've escalated this labor stuff. And how they've created, like, this labors thing is now one of the hottest things on the show.
Well, we were gonna do a podcast, you and I, Sid. We talked about it a few weeks ago when this first got announced, about like, oh, we could speculate on what the labors of Jericho was. I'm really glad we didn't, because we were like, okay, well, he could do some sort of handicap match, or, you know, like this, a sort of stipulation that benefits his opponent, and we can do the one where, oh, you know, it's a really good bit of booking. And I think you alluded to it again on Twitter, saying that having Chris Jericho's final, or, you know, one of his final labors being against Sammy Guevara would be a real interesting sort of morality tale. But I suppose let's just dive straight into it, Sidge, because straight off the back of it, MGF grabs the microphone and says, right, that's it, you're not allowed to have anyone come out and help you anymore. If that happens, the deal's off, basically. So I've tried having a match where the stipulations don't benefit you. So how about we just get a straight up murderer in here, basically. The only MDK that Chris Jericho knows about is McDonald's, Denny's and KFC, probably. That's the line MJF can have for next week. he brings out Nick Gage, a guy who I think he said stabbed someone in the throat or something. Huge reaction for that. He's not properly, but for a week at least, Michael Sidgwick, Nick Gage is all elite.
Absolutely unbelievable. One more note on the match, just to emphasize this, because I really did think it was like a strong match. They weren't just going mad for Chris Jericho, because we saw a little bit of it in the Mox Carl Anderson match last week, where everyone was high as hell on Mox, but then for the first 4 minutes, they didn't really take Carl Anderson seriously as a challenger until they thought, you know what, he's putting his working boots on, let's react to what they're doing. So this really does underline that this was a really strong TV match. Like, they were with a Shawn Spears match every single step of the goddamn way. Like, psychologically, in terms of the heat and how they cut it all off and how they arranged the chair spots, and Chris Jericho was so good at placing a weapon in a certain place, doing the bit where you actually try to use it because it's not just a transition, but then you don't because you're hiding it in plain sight for a spot, and how they informed the finish with the chair wedge between the second and top rope. But I just generally thought this was a really well put together thing. And I think the audience reaction and how they stayed with it literally every step of the way accounts for that. But goddamn, this Nick Gage thing is so unbelievably inspired. Like, it feels like we were thinking about this Labors of Jericho thing. Right, it's a trick that AEW used. It's a great one. It guarantees good episodic TV. It delays the match, avoids rematches, blah, 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 blah. We were looking at it like, oh, they've done this before. It's probably not going to be as good as the Cody MJF thing. Maybe it might be a diminished return. This is unbelievable. So inspired. If you're MJF, and think about this from a character perspective, if you're MJF, you're trying desperately to not fight this man, right? And you're trying to put him through hell because you're a sociopathic knobhead, like the MJF character is. And he gets like an actual violent criminal in to do the violent criminals genre specialist match. And not only are you doing that, but it's a completely incomprehensible, amazing thing that this guy is going to be on network television. He's like a folk hero, a living legend among cult circles. And just the idea of MJF standing next to him was this amazing brain scrambling image. And because excitement in pro wrestling begets more excitement, I can see in my head that Nick Gage won't win, but he's so violent, he's got such an aura that he will make you think he will in the course of the match, which, to be fair to Spears, I never thought that was going to happen. Maybe MJF could berate him for not doing it, and then you get MJF versus Nick Gage. Like, inexplicably awesome, so creative. Instantly, this storyline has been elevated from worthy, good, not the thing I'm most excited about on the show, if I'm being honest, to like a star pro wrestling storytelling. Because it's not just Nick Gage and the novelty of it, but how the logic and the storytelling beats have informed the next one. Like, there's a genuine reason in kayfabe, in character, for MJF to get Nick Gage, not just what a mad match graphic this is. Like, right, okay, well, doesn't matter if you can't play by the rules. Just as have none and have the worst person you would want to face in a fight like this. Just glorious episodic TV storytelling, all of this.
I'm not sure if I mentioned this. It's a given, really. It was a no DQ match, you know, with Nick Gage, obviously. But I'm not sure if I mentioned that as part of my recap. Hamplet, your thoughts?
There's equal magic to MJF running away from Nick Gage and looking over his shoulder as there is MJF paying him off to work this match. That is like such a tremendous character detail now and then going forward. I would probably be a bit less generous to the match, but it was elevated by a hot crowd and they worked that crowd. So I kind of want to like take with one and then give back with another, because like I wasn't like mad into the match, but like Chris Jericho especially was like willing and trying as hard as he possibly could to extract more than just a reaction for his entrance. You wanted it for the match too. And a little detail I really like is that, and I got this out of MJF on commentary, and then it was kind of revealed in the form of him having MDK, Nick Gage backstage waiting for that sort of moment, is this idea that even within his own stable, MJF's a piece of Like, he doesn't really respect Sean Spears. He was hoping it would work out, but deep down he must have known it hasn't, because he's got this ridiculous surprise already lined up on the stage the second the match is finished. It's not like, right, next week I'm going to have to think of something else. I thought Sean Spears would do enough. Like, the implication is that he'd been on the phone to Nick Gage. They're like, well, my man's going to fall short. He sucks. So can you come in and do the damage? But I think that's by design. Like, he was almost patronizingly full of praise on commentary towards Sean Spears. And it almost makes me think that he wanted FTR. FTR brought Tully, and Tully was like, oh, can you do something for my nephew? Like, and he's had to drag Sean Spears in. And I just think that's a nice detail of the, like, ultimately the turmoil that will come from a stable ran by a sociopath like MJF. I think that's like just a really neat character touch. Yeah, the Nick Gage reveal was unreal. Absolutely brilliant. When Kenny Omega won the world title and the first thing he did was run away with Don Callis and have Don Callis say, we'll tell you all about this on Impact. It was for moments like this. There were two separate thrills converging about the announcement of Nick Gage. One was that Nick Gage is going to fight Chris Jericho in a bloody no disqualification match next week. That is in itself a thrill. Here he is on Impact. The other one was that there is no wrong answer to the question, well, who might AEW bring in for this? We have never, not only we've never had opposition to WWE, but we've never had opposition where all bets are off.
Mm.
Like, every single week, if they're talking about a mystery partner or future labors of Chris Jericho, or when the trios division exists and you're looking for like insta trios to set up because you need opponents, let's say, there's no wrong answers anymore. This has moved as it felt like it was doing the second that they mentioned Impact. And then again, when Kenta appeared on Dynamite, this is another extension of that. The thrill of Nick Gage appearing was yet more enhanced thrill of they can get whoever they want. The old rules are dead. The old, it's Vince McMahon or bust. It's your NXT roster or bust. Well, Tony Khan just likes some wrestlers, and if he wants to, he can. Or the Young Bucks have got mates. They desperately want to get a payday. Or this guy that you always really liked, who should have been still in the industry, can be back in the industry again, whatever. There's nobody that they can't go for. Like, dream as big as you want, and there is a chance you might get that favorite. And that is such an awesome feeling, like, to have back as a fan. And to have that as an established rule of a mainstream television wrestling show is incredible. It's a, like, honestly, like, luxuriate in that. Mm. And don't be like called a daft dreamer if one week you want a fantasy book your favorite New Japan guy to show up, because they might, because Nick Gage has just rocked up to fight Chris Jericho as the, I know we're jumping ahead, as the Painmaker. So they've almost done two. Because it's like, oh, we've got Nick Gage, have we? Well, you can have that New Japan psychopath as well while you're at it. It's ridiculous. It's a ridiculous graphic, and it's been booked with no notice for a massive TV show next week. Dream as big as you like.
It is. I said this on the news, and I've said it a lot, to be fair, and I get a bit hyperbolic with it, but it's such a brilliant time to be a wrestling fan right now. I was chatting to a friend of mine who's very lapsed over the weekend. And he's someone who also has been like, what's going on with this AEW sort of thing? And I was really trying to hammer home, and everyone should, you know, WWE, people have stopped watching that. They should get back into that because they're throwing everything in the wall. It's gone wild. But particularly, I was like, you need to start watching AEW. If you haven't, they'll explain stuff, not spoon feed it to you, but they'll explain stuff. You ain't just going to go, well, this is, you know, we won't give you any backstory to it. Because it's just such a thrilling time, as Hamflet alluded to it there. Following that huge announcement, we got a little video by Miro just threatening everyone again. Basically, he will defend the TNT title at Homecoming, I think it was, he announced. Yes,
yeah,
I've written, he will defend the TNT title at, and then forgot to write that sentence, but I knew it wasn't next week, so I'm fairly certain it's Homecoming. And then we got Frankie Kazarian, the Elite Hunter, as he was described as a little bit later on, versus Doc Gallows. You had some reservations about this, Hamflet, so I'll come to you in a second. I'll run through what happened. Kazarian immediately goes after Doc Gallows. Carl Anderson's at ringside, so he probably needs to, because he knows the numbers game is actually going to catch up with him. He hits him with a missile dropkick, but it's Gallows. So Gallows has the power advantage. He hits him with a huge big boot to take control here. Takes Kazarian out to the floor, throws him out there, I should say, where, of course, yep, cheap shot from Carl Anderson out there. Later on, Kazarian avoids some shots from Gallows, takes him down, clothesline, back suplex, springboard, leg drop for a near fall. Anderson gets involved again. He gets taken out with a leg bulldog, but that allows Gallows to hit a right hand and that sit-out tree slam for the victory. Post-match, Anderson attacks and they hit him with the Magic Killer. Again, I'm going to do this in two parts, Hamplet. We'll talk about what happened post-Magic Killer in due course. But as I said, you were intrigued as to which version of Doc Gallows would show up and how this would work with Frankie Kazarian. How was it?
It was rubbish. Like, I had my reservations and I think they were founded. Like, I look like my Kevin Nash radar beeps every time Doc Gallows is on screen. Like, go and make that money off this stupid industry because you've fallen on your back enough times to earn it. But, like, you're not very entertaining when you do it. He's so funny. Like, I'd want him around too. I'd have him working at What Culture if he wasn't in wrestling. He's clearly a blast. And yet, like, this was rubbish. This didn't feel elite level wrestling. The booking was perplexing because you've pretty much killed Kazarian. I don't think that's hyperbolic to say. I think you might have killed the Elite Hunter as a preeminent threat. The audience received this as if they were watching a scabby value range version of the feud they like, which is the Elite versus Hangman Page, etc. You know, like, that's evidently what they really want. Evidently going to be amazing. Is amazing. This was kind of like the worst version of that. Neither man got a great reaction. None of it felt special. None of it felt worthy. Kaz getting beat didn't even feel like... It was bad booking, but it was like, it didn't leave me feeling, oh no, it was just like, oh, halfway through the match, I stopped caring. So never mind that he's been beat. Like, maybe the Elite Hunter wasn't somebody to invest in all along. Not even a disappointment because I didn't have high expectations, but not good. Not good. The promo after the fact was loads better. It was really fun. Kenny Omega not being able to do The Hunter Has Become The Hunted was a treat again. Like, as funny for totally different reasons as Bangkok, baby. Like, because he just knows what he's doing. Like, this week's dig at WWE's overscripted wrestler is forgetting your line. Like, he's got one every week. Like, you know, me and Tony were talking in the back. Like, he knows what he's doing with this character, and it's great and it's funny. But even that, even this Page and Hangman Dark Order runoff thing was the, we've got none of that story left to tell. Let's get to the match next week. Like, that was far from rubbish, but it didn't feel anywhere near as urgent or as, like, era-defining as last week's promo was. None of this, like, reached any kind of apex for me.
Yeah, I unironically liked Doc Gallows yesterday. Today, I ironically like Doc Gallows. Everything about the strength or lack thereof of the match, like, he's such a funny guy. Just why can't you apply the ridiculous stuff you do in, say, the back of a limo with the Elite just to try and pop the books? If that's what you're trying to do, do that in a match. Now, what's wrong with you? Just told, like, oh, he got us in trouble with the network last time, so just be the big, bruising, generic, big guy. I don't understand any of this at all, if I'm being honest. The match was absolutely nothing to write home about. Any colourful aspects of Doc Gallows were just stripped away as soon as he got into the ring. The crowd, the worst thing is, like, the crowd didn't care about the Elite Hunter. They've been going wild for his cameos because he does them, like, to just add chaos upon chaos, and it's just this thrilling thing. I hate to say it, but, like, it just, the crowd aren't connecting with it. And it's a goddamn shame. Sometimes these things just don't connect, and this for whatever reason. And I hate it because there's so much ambition behind this Elite Hunter gimmick. They've done so much work, not enough of it on Dynamite. Possibly that's the problem, Matt Jackson. hasn't happened enough on Dynamite, so it doesn't feel Dynamite worthy. Who the hell knows? It's a shame. It's so ambitious. It's been plotted so well, if not on the right platform. No one cared. The match is generic, short. And if you're going to beat him down, why beat him? What's the plan here? I'm just so confused about the messaging, because surely when you've got an Elite Hunter, the idea is you are to get behind him the more he hunts off the Elite one by one by one by one and gets to Kenny in the end.
Mm.
He's had two matches against the Elite on Dynamite, and he's got beaten both of them. There was the worst trios match of the year they've done on a Friday Dynamite, and now he's beat off Doc Gallows.
He didn't even, he wasn't even back in the ring with Paige and the Dark Order when they ran them off. He was
so odd. It was just
such a bag of trash in the angle that he was just pushed off to the side.
Yeah, it was just odd, perplexing, to the point where, as much as Kenny Omega's line was great, and I love this idea that he's legitimately playing a caricature of a WWE TV star because he's got it in his head that people have told him from day one that he was going to fail at it. It's genuinely really, really good stuff. And yet, despite a great line to build on that character, I was just in a mood, so I couldn't even pop that much. I was just totally dumbfounded by all of this. Like, what does Kazarian do next?
It was a weird, the moment he hit the tree slam, I was like, well, that looks like it's going to be the finish. It was. And yeah, it's a hitman and his kill list just failing at stage one. It's really, really strange. But let's delve a little bit into what happened post-match, Sige. Omega comes out flanked by Don Callis. He said to Kazarian, this is what happens when you mess with the Elite. Actually, he also said, was it, welcome to my home, said the spider to the fly. he said that Kazarian had been a thorn in their side for months, but now the Elite Hunter has become... Don Callis gets in his ear. Oh, yeah, the Elite Hunter, thank you. So Hangman's Page's music plays. He comes out, drink in hand, of course. And Callis says, not sure if you've noticed, but we got a 4-on-1 numbers advantage here. Are you stupid or are you just drunk? He doesn't care. He fights. He's you know, eventually beaten down. Of course, the numbers game did catch up to him, but the Dark Order run out to even the odds, and Page hits a buckshot lariat on Carl Anderson. And Sige, you mentioned it, and when we talked about it yesterday, you were like, let's have one match on this show, or, you know, two or three other matches. We've not got that. We've got a shed load of others, but we also have the Elite versus Hangman Page and the Dark Order next week. And I suppose if you're going to do it next week, as much as we adored what happened last week, this is a hell of a way to build to it.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think last week's angle was so strong that people were like, all right, well, that's the go-home angle for this 10-man. So this felt superfluous and damaging. The brawl itself was only okay. But I do like the specific members of the Dark Order they've selected. Like, they basically are going for the absolute best match possible. You've got Silver and Reynolds, who are a great, cracking undercard tag team. They'll do some great stuff in here. Grayson and Uno and Hangman. That's the way to do it. Like, that is the way to do it. So, again, like, a lot of my enjoyment of this week's Dynamite hinged on the goddamn look of next week's show.
What do you reckon is going to be longer next week, considering I'm not in control of the NXT review, because I think they'll be off, or maybe the preview? What's going to be longer? Our preview of that next week's card or the entire review of NXT?
Well, I'm in the driver's seat, baby, so I know what's going to happen.
I think we all know the answer, don't we?
Team Taz video. Taz is proud of Ricky Starks winning the FTW Championship, and Starks announces they're going to have a championship celebration next week. Brian Cage sees this, gets asked about it, and says, oh, that works out. I love a good celebration, me. So ominous, obviously. We all know where that's going. And then we got Darby Allin versus Wheeler Yuta. Darby Allin, of course, naturally, despite how unkillable he is, has taped ribs after that insane coffin match with Ethan Page last week. That allows Yuta to get some offense in. He gets some near falls in there. Drops Allin on the ropes on his ribs, of course, and then puts him in an octopus hold. Allin escapes. He gets a German suplex bridge for a two count as well. But Allin, in the end, fights back, pulls Yuta off the ropes, hits a superplex. Then we get the spot with Sting and Orange Cassidy doing the Orange Cassidy kicks and all that. And Sting even does a lazy sort of chest beat in amongst it all. Yuta tries to take advantage with the distraction with a roll-up, but Darby Allin hits his stunner, coffin drop, 1-2-3, post-match. The Blade attacks Orange Cassidy with the brass knucks, because, of course, they're fighting later on. Sid, you smiled greatly when I talked about the Sting-Orange Cassidy thing. One of many things we probably didn't expect to see in 2021, that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about this show. I think... I'm trying to crack, it's a bit of a riddle, a bit of a puzzle, this show. It's like, the things you were meant to care about didn't always hit. The things you weren't meant to care about and just enjoying the moment was so enjoyable that the mood about this show just completely heightened. And I mean, the Sting and Orange Cassidy thing, the second they started to look at each other, I just felt like gripped by pro wrestling magic. And that's exactly what it was. It was a ridiculous amount of fun, which you can read as nothing more than Thistle Pop you and Sting likes Orange Cassidy. That's all it was. Like, that's
Sting shot first.
You were?
Sting shot
first. Yeah. Just absolutely class, irreverent, totally pointless, but still really amusing. Like, the AEW, not to sound like a total mark about it, but it is like a dream factory. Like, it is. And they love that bit about themselves. And they just thought, people will pop that for this, so why not do it? It's more, let's extract every single droplet of milk from this Big Mommy Milker tit. That is the return of live crowds. And they did that with Sting lazily pounding his chest. What a goddamn treat. The match itself was too short to be anything, but I'd run this back for 10 minutes. It was class. It's so class that it almost verges on pointless. The idea is that, I think, Tony Khan's realized, oh, that's Yuta's class. Yeah, he's a babyface and he's aligned with babyface, but like just seven fights, two babyfaces for 8 minutes in total because like he's meant, there were certain counters in here that for how fluffy this was and how short it was and how predictable it was, like I still got my pulse racing. It like how good some of the counter wrestling was. So I would like to see this round back. I would like to see Yuta getting signed. I don't know why I watched this, but I bloody loved it.
It's quite shrewd because if he does like Yuta, then you're putting him with a guy who gets the numbers and gets the eyes on him. So you're going to get Darby Allin's eyes on Yuta, aren't you? Which is good. There was a spot that mirrored almost Sami Zayn's corner brainbuster, like where he did like a suplex across the turnbuckle, and like it almost got missed or went to picture in picture because it was like just before the advert. It was the one memorable bit of the match, to be honest, that I thought was pedestrian. But I couldn't have loved Orange Cassidy and Sting anymore. Like my favorite bit of the show, Sting again. Like I feel like I'm just talking about like things that are too subjective, energies, vibes, you know, feelings, rather than any kind of objective analysis of the matches or of the booking or anything like that. If you allow, a very small diversion. Like, the UK has got a very rich history with comedy, but it's also got a lot of miserable old bastards from club comics past that believe, like, young person's comedy to be rubbish now because it's not racist enough or it's not sexist enough or it's not homophobic.
My wife.
Yeah, all that sort of bollocks. Barry Cryer, comedian, comedy writer, 86-year-old, I think he is at the moment, still presents on Radio 4, still puts over young comics whenever he can, goes and watches young comics on the scene because he cares about the art and he wants it to be improved and he doesn't want to be one of them people that just because his era was the 50s, 60s and 70s that he thinks that's where comedy should be because he understands that art constantly needs to progress and move forward. Like, and I just get such a nice feeling when I'm like watching Barry Cryer talk about comedy or be a comedy performer because he still cares enough about the craft. That's Sting pissing about with Orange Cassidy. How? And like, I don't want to name his name, but you know who I'm talking about. To quote the late, great New Jack, the one that gets with a tennis racket, like how can he say something about the Orange Cassidy act when Sting is out there doing Orange Cassidy bits? Because he gets the industry and he gets what makes it work and what makes it tick and what makes it fun. Orange Cassidy's act, and we've always said this on this podcast, is way more conventional than bad faith actors would have you believe in terms of what gets over in pro wrestling. And Sting, being in Sting, understands that and knows how to interact with that. Glorious, absolutely glorious, immediately viral, worthy of it, and probably the highlight of the whole show. And will make this Darby Allin Yuta match memorable as a result. They've crafted a spot that will make this match matter, I don't know, Christ, years from now, because people will remember this. This will be in a video package sometime and we'll lovingly remember it.
Absolutely spot on analysis. And I've got obscure British reference bingo on this week's podcast. So there we go.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Right, let's talk Britt Baker, Nyla Rose. It was Britt Baker's first defense of the AEW Women's Championship. Again, Hamflet, we have had reservations going into this. The build to it has been iffy. And, I want to know if you thought this match lived up to the hype, the hype that Britt Baker has, and whether Nyla Rose has presented the right sort of a first opponent for the first title defense. In the match itself, Rose, was again, power game here, catches Baker when she's running at her, press slam, running senton. Puts her over the top rope to do that huge knee drop thing that she does. But Rebel Reba pulls her off and Baker flatlines Rose into the turnbuckle. Again, later on, Rose overpowers Baker, hits a backbreaker, fall away slam sort of combo. But Baker avoids that cannonball in the corner, hits a sling blade, backslide. The crowd thinks she gets a three off the back of that. Why they thought on earth that was going to be the finish, I've no idea. I'm not sure exactly what happened there. So Baker gets the glove and Tony, like a proud but terrified father's going, stop messing about, get on with it, do it, stop looking at the camera. And he's right, because as Baker goes to hit the lockjaw, Rose catches a ghost for a chokeslam. Baker rolls out of it, though, gets a cradle for a two count. Again, she tries for the lockjaw, but Rose hits her with a Death Valley driver. That draping leg drop dive thing off the top rope gets hit this time. She gets a good near fall off the back of that. Baker fights back with thrust kicks. Rose hits a chokeslam for another near fall. Baker sort of hits a crucifix bomb, rolls Rose up, another two count. Curb stomps, another two count. Rose, though, fires back up, levels her with a forearm. Double down. In the midst of all this, Rebel Reba jumps up on an apron, distracts the official. In the midst of all this, she gets Baker the belt. Eddie Guerrero spot. But Vicky's up on the apron as well, and they reverse it. So it's Baker holding the belt as Rose is down selling for her as the referee turns back around. But the match continues. Rose hits a beast bomb, really close near fall, goes for another one, but Baker counters, lockjaw, submission. Britt Baker retains the title. But what did you make of the match, Hamflet?
So like the first 10 minutes lived down to the expectations of a really bad build. And then the last two lived up to the fact that Britt Baker is one of the biggest money-drawing stars this show has. Mm. And I can't still now work out which one matters the most, because it was a bad match for the most part. It was sloppy. Execution was poor. I still have significant concerns about their agenting of Britt Baker as a tweener, if that's what we're calling her. I do not think the current... You can't compromise this amazing relationship she's got with the fans. That pop, that, like I tweeted this, so I'm going to have to use the same word again. Britt Baker's pop is exhilarating. It is exhilarating, that reaction when Britt Baker arrives. I want to buy a ticket to be in the crowd when that happens, because a star is here, DMD. The match was really sloppy for the most part. And then everybody absolutely came unglued, much like the Shida match, by the way, came unglued for the last 2.5 minutes, because it absolutely matters if Britt Baker wins or retains, in this case, the women's title. So I cannot work out if this is good for the division or not. Like, on it, like, I'm still trying to figure it out now. I think if you can fix the heel babyface dynamic of this character's in-ring, you probably fix everything. I hope that they're going to steer into some fantasy booking of mine from last week with the QT Marshall promo later on, because there are several wrestlers backstage waiting for an awesome match with Britt Baker. And I think Britt Baker needs an awesome match. And I think there's one that we're all thinking of that would give her the most awesome match that she could really do with right now. I was reminded of when Nia Jax punched Becky Lynch in the face, she was the hottest star in the world and she was written off television for like 2 months. And her comeback matches was a ladder match with Asuka and Charlotte and a singles match with Asuka, which was going to protect Becky Lynch's legacy as the man in terms of in-ring. Britt Baker has not been so fortunate here in this feud with Nyla Rose. There has not been somebody that can obscure what might be received as Britt Baker's in-ring foibles, shall we say. She needs a Thunder Rosa quality match. She needs a Serena Deeb level opponent to fix these little nagging issues with this title reign, because the last 2 minutes were everything you could want for from a champion, from a figurehead, because the crowd bit on everything, like everything. Everything pretty much from the Eddie Guerrero teases onwards, and they were putty, which is perfect. But 10-minute sloppy matches beforehand and not going to keep passing the bar.
Yeah, what happened here? And the prevailing sense I had watching this is that she's got away with it again. And is that star power? Is that just an ability to drag it over the line? Or is it lucky? Like, I'm like Hamflet, I don't know where exactly to place my firm opinion. What happened here, and it happened in the Sheeta match as well, is that they had an absolutely beautiful piece of sheet music and they couldn't actually execute the notes for a large part of it. Ambitious in terms of the way it was laid out, the counters, how many moves were in it, and it felt like they were not engaged in this organic scrap. They weren't seamless and super smooth in their performance. It felt like the match structure had overwhelmed them to the point where you could see them visibly struggling to do certain spots that they'd been asked to do or that they had collaborated with the agents on or whatever for so long that even this crowd, high as hell as they were on Baker, were kind of getting lost. Like they were just like the blind leading the blind almost. Then the last 3 minutes happened and they were electrifying to the point where they were so good that what was trending almost to disaster levels felt like anything but wildly uneven. I don't know what the answer is. I don't know if you put Baker in there with a superior worker. I don't know if she just needs more reps because there's a certain muscle memory missing with Baker in the ring that you can only get by just working and working and working and working. And with the pandemic, the dentist job, the schedule, I don't know what the answer is. Maybe shave a few minutes off here or there. Maybe don't give a Nyla Rose as an opponent, but, you know, there aren't that many Serena Deebs. There just aren't. But her sheer star power gets these things over the line in the end. But I'm not as high on the reality of the title run as I was the prospect. The need to have a little bit of a look at how to correct this at this point. 3 minutes off every match. A bit more basic. There was a lot of like hold transitions, and Baker's usually really good at it, but like, yeah, it just felt like they were actively, visibly trying to recall things and talk each other through it and didn't work. But then 3 minutes were ace at the end.
Sid, what do you think of the press conference came afterwards? It was FTR and Santana and Ortiz talking about the fact that they're basically the same. But Ortiz responds to FTR by saying, "You're just a pit stop on the way to tag team gold." Santana pulls out photos, talks about his childhood, his family's upbringing, his mother. And Dax Harwood says, "I care about three things, and that's God, family, and pro wrestling. The only thing left to do is show up and beat your ass." And they're gonna fight next week. We're getting the match.
It's about bloody time we got the match, because this build has been okay, but protracted. And it's good, again, I call this, it's good that they're doing it in North Carolina with FTR. Again, they've arranged all of this to maximize superstar reactions to the hometown guys. This was good in terms of content, good in terms of premise, anything with a sport and flavor I like. Santana was great. Dax Harwood was great. It, however, was so clearly not a press conference.
Yeah.
There were no members of the press there. The whole staging and the blocking looked very, very fake. And it was so bizarrely edited.
Oh,
the editing was so awful on this. Like, there's this big emotional crescendo that Santana was trying to reach, and then the next minute it felt so spliced in that the editing was so bizarre. It was fake in every way, which is so odd and suboptimal, when the whole idea is these are four very real men. Just two of them come from very different, albeit real, backgrounds. And then to do something fake like this, irrespective of how well they tried to perform it, it was just too fake, and it just completely undermined everything they're trying to do with this premise.
Like on the first draft, they gave this 5 minutes, and then just beforehand, or you know, when the final draft of the show came out, they went, "Oh, actually, that's only got 2 minutes." And like, we filmed that as a 5-minute segment. And like you say, they just had to cut it really weirdly. You seem to be in agreement.
Yeah, I found this like intensely frustrating. So if the central premise is a press conference, you're right, you would assume it to go maybe 4 or 5 minutes, questions from these voices from off screen to at least mimic the idea, so we never got that. So the press conference thing was dropped pretty much straight away, and it was just some dressed up desks. The cuts were so jarring that not only did they kind of ruin the flow and the momentum of the promos that the wrestlers were cutting, but it broke the immersion, and it allowed you to think, well, hang on, what's actually going on here? Has this been cut because the quality of the verbiage wasn't good enough? Or, and I think this is more likely, has this been cut because AEW still have a massive time management problem? And I was leaning on that one because I want to give the benefit of the doubt to these great talkers and these great performers. So I'm leaning on this fact that like, or this belief I've got that like, yet again, they've not really formatted the show all that well. They've not, like, the time management isn't what it could be. And then Christ almighty, what a segment next to double down on that. Like, so I'm already going into, like, I'm already in a little bit of miffed because like, I really want to love this feud. And, oh God, they must have wasted some time tonight to have to cut this. And it's like, then what I'm seeing next is what they've made time for. Like this going back to back with what came next only left me more pissed off with the feud that I'm pretty invested in the form of FTR and Proud and Powerful, because I thought this was like the next 10 minutes of television was just a total time sink.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. It was Andrade El Idolo. He's brought out by Tony Schiavone. He's got a surprise. He's got a new executive consultant, and it is a man with a magnificent moustache, one Chavo Guerrero. He comes out, puts AEW over, says it's the place to be, looks around the changing room and sees so much talent. But with all due respect, he didn't see anybody with as much talent as Andrade. Death Triangle come out. Of course, Andrade referenced them the previous week. They all come out. The real star of Death Triangle is there, of course, Alex Abrahantes. Pac says, yeah, you mentioned our name last week. We hide from nobody. Andrade, thanks from them for coming. Back and forth in Spanish. Chavo translates for Pac and, well, all the rest of us. They're all talented in Death Triangle. They should all be holding championships. And if they want to change that, they need to listen to Andrade. And Andrade gets the mic and says, one question, why do you work for Pac? Why not work for Andrade El Idolo instead? And Pac said, look, Penner and Phoenix, they don't work for me. This is a family. Phoenix grabs the mic, says that they are the real faces of Latinos. Penner rants in Spanish and it's getting over. Alex says, Penner says, huge pap. Why would we want to join a group with you when you're not even on our level? Death Triangle rush the ring. Andrade tells them to relax. Referees stop them from getting in, and Andrade sort of backs away, flanked by his new executive consultant, Chavo Guerrero. You were talking about this, Hamlet, so I'll give you the floor immediately afterwards.
I'll do the good bit first. I think it was okay to feel like they were foreshadowing the turn. I feel like it was okay to see that, the eventual turn of the Lucha Brothers on Pac. That's pretty great. Who doesn't want to see Lucha Brothers and Andrade rip it up in trios matches? That could be a lot of fun. Maybe that's the magic fix for Andrade. Because Chavo Guerrero isn't the magic fix for Andrade, not by a long shot. Like, I don't want to be Seymour Skinner doing that, must be the children that are wrong. But Christ, what a week for the Benroy era massive. Getting no more words and Chavo Guerrero in the same week. Like, if you were banging a frigging SmackDown in 2008, this is your week in mainstream professional wrestling. I swore at the telly watching live. Like, for sake. Like, it's another fairly irrelevant ex-WWE. I don't want to use that phrase. I want to use a different one. Ex-star being brought in, right? And here's another thing. So Chavo Guerrero is brought in to cut promos for Andrade because they've decided that Andrade shouldn't be cutting promos. That's an argument for another podcast, probably. There's some good, there's some bad in Andrade's talking. But he comes in, he does what amounts to a bit of a rah-rah speech about AEW more than for Andrade. Clearly just like Matt Stryker marking out about the fact that he's got this role, right? Which, by the way, was a dropped promise from Andrade 2 weeks ago, and there was a Pepe sign in the crowd. So it's as if they've been like, we're sitting on the big Chavo news, guys, for like 2 weeks, where like half a fan base, and I saw it happening live, is grumbling on Twitter. Oh, Jesus Christ. I don't mean this to be like a Matt Hardy-style burial of Chavo Guerrero here. It's just, I feel like he's a lot of people's not their guy, Chavo. Like, he's always had that energy. Like, Chavo Guerrero is very few people's guy, and they were presenting him as some, as like, as your guy. Like a Jake Roberts, they were like putting them kind of in the same league. He's not, like, he's just not. And so he comes out and the whole premise is, right, okay, if I absolutely have to buy Chavo, it's because he's confident and competent on the microphone, so he's doing the speaking. Pac has a word, and then Andrade takes the microphone back. So Chavo's just another guy in the ring. He's another member of, he's Vincent in the NWO Black and White. He's just somebody else to stand in the ring as part of a pointless entourage. And then a pull-apart brawl doesn't even happen because the brawls doesn't get started for the referees to pull apart. They break him up before a punch is thrown in anger. This segment was crap. Like, oh, and I feel I don't want to like jump on a point I feel like I know Sidgwick was going to make, but we've had a bit of office discussion this morning at a safe distance. And I disagree with you, Wilborn, on Abrahantes. And I think Sidgwick does too.
Oh.
I'm not sure that he adds. I think I liked him as a commentator, guesting, as getting to like hang out with the wrestlers for 5 minutes. I don't think any of this worked. And I think it's another failed week for Andrade. And I feel immense frustration at the fact that Zelina Vega is getting hypnotized at the top of a ladder instead of coming out and helping her guy get over.
Yeah, Sidge, what do you make of the fact that the contract does read Guerrero? That name.
Right. I'm going to be nice. You know why? Because I'm a goddamn consistent guy with principles and scruples. We've long, for ages on these podcasts, when we've discussed Io Shirai and Hikaru Shida primarily, we've long campaigned for wrestlers who are very talented, who, because they don't speak English amazingly well as their native language, not getting enough TV time or a substantial enough story as a result of that. This was an attempt to correct that. It wasn't a particularly successful one, no, but I really enjoyed that. They're trying. It was just not good. And it wasn't good for several reasons. But please do something more like this. Keep it more compact and make it significantly less confusing than it really needs to be. Because as Hamlet rightly pointed out, if Chavo Guerrero's there to talk, have him talk. I don't want Andrade to be mute. I don't want to stand there doing nothing like Brock Lesnar cashing in his checks. But there needs to be a ratio there. And they just didn't really hit it at all. Like, if he's going to do the talking, he has to do most of it. Not all, but most. Alex Abrahantes, when he comes out, like, almost in gear, doing Zero Miedo, I think he looks like a total dork. And I think, by association, Death Triangle look 90% less cool. He looks like he's won a competition as a super fan. Yeah, to, yeah. Like, at a house show, to come out and like, he can be like, a grand old mascot. He makes them look so less cool, which is such a shame because, again, we were talking about this earlier, Pentagon has got such a presence and a voice that it's like the Tanahashi Atsushi Anita deal. You can't understand, not speaking Japanese, unless you do, obviously, a word they're saying, but you can tell through the presence and everything else that they are amazing promos. Penta's an amazing promo. I just can't understand the promos. He's so cool. He's such a badass. Abrahantes needs to go. Particularly since Pac can really talk. So Abrahantes, I'm sorry, it's not worked out. Penta says, I don't think it's quite getting over as much as he wants it to or they want it to. Get rid. I don't know why Andrade's got a guy with a touchpad. Unless they've got something lined up. I don't know why he's there. I don't know. It's odd. But being nice, like, this went on too long. Chavo's not it. They teased at least a direction that either the surprise, and I think there's going to be a different one, because I'm bargaining, because this company has generated that kind of blind faith at this point, as at least it pertains to this angle. Either Andrade is going to bring in some kind of dream world, Forbidden Door scenario, like Rush and Dragon Lee, which I don't think is going to happen, because I think ROH is like out in the cold from all of this. Or Eligio Delvecchio or, you know, AAA, like the Rio Kid or whatever, guys. Or Lucha Brothers are going to align with Andrade, and Pac could possibly like play straight man to like two total dorks, and you can have some nice fun with that or whatever. They've teased a storyline direction or two, and that's the absolute nicest possible thing I can say about something that I would really genuinely like to see done again, but much better.
Two segments then of what can only be described as, well, they're on the road to something happening, I suppose. They showed a clip again. They did this last 2 weeks ago, before the Brian Cage thing, where earlier on in the night, the HFO, the Hardy Family Office, had battered Marco Stump. Jurassic Express, alongside Christian Cage, ran out to make the save. And Christian was backstage with Luchasaurus and Jungle Boy and suggested he team them against Angelico and Private Party next week. And then we also had QT Marshall with Alex Marvez saying, "Don't you need to worry, Alex. I'm not going to pour a protein shake over your head. It's because Tony Schiavone, you know, sort of negged me a bit. But next week, I'll apologize for all that." It's happening is the best way I can describe this, Sige.
What's happening?
Well, we're getting potentially Michael Hamlet's booking with QT Marshall and Tony Schiavone, and another step on what I suppose we assume is going to be the inevitable turn from Christian Cage on Jungle Boy. What did you think of both segments?
I don't think much of anything. I don't know. I'm hoping the Serena Deeb thing's happening, but I'm not sure either way. Like, QT Marshall has got an influence in that room, and I'm starting to worry that he's abusing it because there are more people realistically I'd like to see. It's not a knock on QT Marshall. He's very talented. There are more talented guys who are more pop off the screen TV guys who should be utilized more than they are. The Christian Cage stuff is nice. The Hardy Family Office is a weird stable. They've got three tag teams in it. And I know Butcher's not there, so it doesn't really count. That's generous. They've still got two tag teams in it, and they should be, you know, competitors in the division. It's all very odd. I'm starting to really want to get past Jungle Boy versus Matt Hardy. I kind of want the turn. And I know I'm being impatient, and I know it'll mean more the longer it happens, blah, 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 blah. But everything around Christian Cage versus Jungle Boy is nowhere near as interesting as the direct, or rather indirect, teases of, "Oh, you bastard, are you going to turn on Jungle Boy?" Like, more of that, less of the pretense to the contrary.
It would be quite nice, based on the outwork everyone ethos that Christian will turn out to pretend to have had when he does turn, if he uses and abuses his relationship with Jurassic Express to eradicate like six wrestlers at once in the form of the Hardy Family Offices, and then to turn on Jungle Boy and say, "Well, I don't have to outwork everyone because you helped me get rid of some of them, and now I'm going to destroy you, you cheeky little bastard, for stealing my title shot against Kenny Omega a couple of months back." I'd take that now. I don't need much more layering, I don't think, because it doesn't feel terribly current otherwise. It doesn't feel like super topical all of a sudden.
Orange Cassidy versus The Blade came next. Very nearly didn't happen. The Blade came out. Orange Cassidy wasn't there for his entrance, and everyone, including The Blade, assumed that the attack with the brass knucks had taken him out of the match, and he wanted the referee to raise his hand. But in snuck Orange Cassidy, attacks him. The match jump starts. Blade, though, later on, still using his wily git ways, pretends to be injured in the corner. Bunny checks on him. The referee checks on him. And that allows Blade to pop back up. Surprise Orange, takes him down. But then Orange eventually counters the suplex into his stunner. They fight on the top rope. Oh, my days. Blade is just ridiculous sometimes. A gut-wrench powerbomb off the top turnbuckle. That takes us into the break. Later on, Bunny tries to get involved. Chris Statlander tries to even the odds. Orange goes for a dive through the ropes onto the Blade, but Blade pulls Statlander into the way. So to counteract that, Orange pushes Blade into the Bunny. Blade hits a running lariat, spinning tombstone pile driver effectively, gets a two count. Goes for the Doctor Bomb, but Orange Cassidy fights that. He's been trying to hit it all the time, but his back kept giving out. He finally managed to hit the beach break. Bunny distracts the official, gets the brass knucks again to the Blade, but Orange dodges it and hits the Orange Punch for the victory. And post-match, he pops on the brass knucks himself and hits another Orange Punch, just for good measure, on the Blade. Hamlet, your take?
Very little. I think they knew that this match didn't have a lot going for it, hence like an angle earlier on in the show to try and heat it up more for the live crowd. And I hope that that live crowd would bite on that investment and thus elevate this for the TV viewers. It was fine. Like it was fine work. It was better than NXT fine because there was an atmosphere, and it was better than Raw or SmackDown fine because the characters are more interesting. But it was like just fine for AEW. Like the standards are way higher of what you would expect from like a Dynamite match between two fairly well fleshed out characters. I really like that Orange Cassidy's got the brass knuckles now. I like that he's can add a superpower to the orange punch cheekily every now and then. For the man that reaches in his pocket to one day come out with the knuckles on his hand is a pretty cool payoff once in a while. So something has come from this, but the rest of it I thought was pretty pedestrian.
I like this. I think I would have been way higher. If this was like a uniformly great episode of wrestling TV, this would have got over so much more as the fun bit, the crowd-pleasing bit. As it happens, it followed like a not particularly great block of pro wrestling TV. So it felt way more, like way less fun than it ordinarily would have been, if that makes any sense whatsoever, because I really was ready for something amazing. And this was never going to be an amazing match, but I was ready for something like that that just sort of almost saved the show. But viewed on its individual merits away from this kind of dampened vibe that it sort of was worked within, I really enjoyed it. The powerbomb, buckle bomb thing was absolutely awesome. And what I really liked about the brass knuck stuff is they, in the last 3 or 4 minutes of this match, they always added an extra twist. He never quite got the brass knuckles when he thought he was going to. That came like one move later. He never made the comeback when he thought he was going to. There was always one little obstacle to get the happy ending. I thought they put a lot of work and thought into the crowd-pleasing moment to almost get the show back on track. Like, this is way more fun than functional, even though it was functional.
Hamflet mentioned it earlier, Sid. We didn't get your thoughts on Chris Jericho after this revealing. He's going to bring the most violent and demented version of himself next week for that match with Nick Gage. He reveals he's going to bring the Painmaker back.
It was odd, this. I knew exactly what they were doing, and I know what Chris Jericho does. Chris Jericho apparently went to see Michael Jackson in concert, like well before he was cancelled. He's always been cancelled. I'm not going to talk about Michael Jackson. He went to see Michael Jackson in concert and he saw him do the thing, arms outstretched. And because Michael Jackson was possibly the biggest, megastar of our era, of our lifetimes.
Like his death was Elvis dying, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You remember where you were when you heard that Michael Jackson died?
He's certainly the most famous guy in the entire world when I was a kid. So because of this, when he did the Y2J debut, he just outright thingied it. People knew he was going to be there. People wanted him to be there. And he just decided to get a pop and illustrate his inherent star power by standing there like that. But this was filmed in such a weird way I can't articulate that I always felt it was someone dressing up like Jericho for a laugh for a few seconds. I thought, oh, it's the Painmaker. So that was a little bit more amusing than I think it was intended to be. However, the idea, the premise is fantastic. Chris Jericho, the man who is so great at reinventing himself, or he's better at marketing his reinventions, because some of them took a little bit too long to really get good, or he took a little bit too long to abandon an old passé persona. But regardless, he's earned the right to be able to say that every single time he's on a podcast. And he's got an alter ego to the fresh role that he currently plays. That's great. It implicitly puts over Nick Gage when, ahead of Chris Jericho beating him, I have to resort to this dark place in my head, or whatever you want to spin it as. All excellent, all very good. I can't wait for next week.
Just to think about this as well, I've not really thought about this until now. The Painmaker makes so much sense for the Nick Gage match in terms of a character and him having to like burrow into something else about himself to get through this. Is the labours of Jericho going to play with Chris Jericho's like wrestling CV effectively? So you've had like the champion effectively work against Sean Spears and win, and now he's going to be the Painmaker. is MJF going to dust off Lance Storm or something? And he's going to, Jericho's going to have to be a thrill seeker and out wrestle the wrestler for the night or something along those lines. You know what I mean? Is the possibility that this is actually foreshadowing him having to like dust off all the versions of Jericho for the labors of Jericho so that you get the very best composite for MJF?
No, because when they were doing the sit down at Road Rage, some nice people decided to chant Y2J Chris Jericho because they like him. He's like, don't call me that anymore, not him. Reinvented myself. I'll tell you this on every single podcast.
Oh, gosh.
It's like, right. Very protective over these reinventions as Chris Jericho. Mm. As I would be too if I had such an incredibly illustrious career. Because as I've said before, like the harshest thing about being a pro wrestler is that the more bumps you take, the more people don't give a toss about you. It's so cruel inherently. And he's done really well to have such longevity. Everyone knows this. So when people go, oh, yeah, that's why Y2J, he goes, I'm not. They've got a studio album since then. It's not greatest hits to her. So that's his mentality.
Maybe one of the Labours of Jericho is going to have to sit through an entire Fozzy album. Who knows? So next week it is going to be the Painmaker versus Nick Gage. No DQ. Insane lineup for a fight for the.
I think Chris Jericho. That joke doesn't work because if Chris Jericho was listening to a Fozzy album,
yeah,
he'd be absolutely vibing.
Yeah, fair point. That I know we talked about the Taz meme, but the cat bobbing its head, that'll be Chris Jericho listening to the Fozzy album. Sidge, I'm going to double check with you because otherwise I'm going to be really embarrassed and butcher his name. Hikuleo? How am I saying this?
Hikuleo.
Okay, yeah. Hikuleo, that's
who... It's I haven't heard it enough to get it.
Tommy Tango's brother. He's going to be facing the winner of the IWGP US title match we're going to talk about in a second. You've also got FTR versus Santana Ortiz, Christian Cage and Jurassic Express versus Private Party and Anelico, Tony Khan announcing a major new live event. And of course, as we've talked about before, the Elite, Kenny Omega, Young Bucks and the Good Brothers versus Hangman Page and members of the Dark Order, Evil Uno, Stu Grayson, Alex Reynolds and Johnny Hungy. And then in 2 weeks, we got a video package hyping this up immediately after this. It's going to be Cody Rhodes versus Malakai Black at AEW Homecoming. Right, Sid, let's talk about this main event. It was I said the word brutal quite a few times, savage death, Texas death match for the IWGP US title. John Moxley defending against Lance Archer. No DQ, last man standing rules. And yeah, we'll talk about it. I'll review it and then I'll get your thoughts, Sidge. But I already know. Hang on. Is this a good last man standing match? Yeah, it was. Moxley immediately goes after Archer, of course. But Moxley gets caught with a pounce, followed by a running cannonball sent onto the floor by Archer. They go through the barricade via a running shoulder tackle. They brawl into the crowd. Moxley jumps off some stuff. And Archer grabs a fan and uses him as a weapon against John Moxley. Later on, Archer dives through the ropes with a forearm, knocks Moxley down, exposes the concrete, but gets caught out by Moxley and hit with a paradigm shift, which busts him wide open. And if you're thinking, oh yeah, but you know, sometimes they've had a bit of blood in it, and it's just a little bit. Yeah. Moxley made sure there was a lot of blood because he got a sodding fork and stabbed it in Archer's face. Moxley's trying to cut down the big man. He puts a chair around Archer's leg, diving stomp onto that, goes to hit him with a lid of a trash can. I don't know why it tickled me so much because I love both guys. But Lance Archer just punching it into Moxley's face was a real highlight for me. Back and forth punches here. And Moxley just decides, I'm not sure if you're bleeding quite enough. Forks, you know, not really cutting it for me. I'll just bite your head. Bites his head, of course. Archer, that just is tight of his own blood yet again, just fires him back up. Ripcord Lariat. Moxley hits a release German, but Archer comes back with a big boot and a black hole slam. Archer sets up some chairs to hit the blackout through it. Moxley gets out and audio doesn't really help here. He flips the chairs around. So rather than falling onto two bits of the seated chairs, you've now got the big edges to fall onto to really bugger up your back. Moxley, amidst all that, to allow him to do it, hit a low blow. But Archer pops back up and choke slams him right onto the edge of the chairs. That's going to suck. Moxley does make it back up, though. The referee, I think, got to about seven, eight. I think it was an eight count. Counters a running tack. hits a lariat, paradigm shift, and Archer to a huge pap, of course, in his home state. Just gets straight back up at four and flips off Moxley. So Moxley goes right back to the fork and just stabs him in the head a few more times. Moxley goes under the ring and gets out those barbed wire boards. There's some tables set up outside. He pops them on both of them. He looks like he's going to win by hitting a paradigm shift on Archer off the apron through the tables and those horrific barbed wire boards. Callback, of course, which I'm sure Sigil will allude to in a second. But Archer uses his own weapon against him. He uses the fork, stabs Moxley, chokes him through the tables. And I think they alluded even to this on commentary. It was a combo of obviously a huge chokeslam through some tables to the outside. And the fact that even if he'd been sufficiently able to just get himself up, he probably couldn't because he was just pinned down because he was tied up in all the barbed wire, which I really loved. And it obviously wasn't intentional, this. But as Moxley was setting it up, it like caught on the ring apron. It's like, that's how easy it can slice flesh. But yes, Lance Archer chokeslams Moxley through the tables with the barbed wire on them. Moxley cannot answer a 10 count. Who could have called this? Oh, yeah, me. Lance Archer is your new IWGP US champion. And then just as a little added bit of sauce, Hikulio, I'm really sorry, gets in the ring and he's taller than Archer. What's going on? That is the close of the show. And what a way to finish it, Sig.
I loved this. It was wild. I think Hamfler previewed it as hog wild. It was even more hog wild than I thought. Like, they reimagined the dreary stop-start anti-drama almost of the Last Man Standing match by marketing it as a Texas death match, with the idea being that I don't want to be the first to die, so I'm just going to try and kill you as fast as I can. Like a Last Man Standing match sprint. What an ingenious idea to get this match over. It was worked so furiously that I was just completely overwhelmed by the violence and the pace. Just thought it was absolutely fantastic. The chair spot looked unbelievable. The finish was... it was sort of one of those matches where there were certain things, right, if you want to really be boring and, like, do our jobs about it, that Archer didn't sell that thing from the chair. I don't care. It's just too gloriously brutal, and it was so clever. Like, these matches never get credit for being clever. And yes, maybe they could have registered the threat of the weapon before they put them through it. That's half the yard. But I didn't care. It was a sprint to the death because... you're massive, Lance Archer. You will kill me. I think it did an absolutely incredible job of putting him over had he not even won the title. That's how smartly worked this was. The finish was so goddamn great because, as you said, John Moxley could get up from that just at the 8 or 9, but he couldn't because he was physically incapable of doing it. Almost ingenious in terms of how they've designed that finish to protect the John Moxley character. And as you said, like that wonderful moment of serendipity that the actual reality of how that finish worked was sort of explained by the fact that it tugged at the ring apron.
Oh,
incredible. Like an incredible lucky moment to complement what was an incredibly fiendishly clever finish. The chair spot was absolutely great. My favorite bit was the fork stuff, where it was such a furious intensity and danger. And like, none of them are going to look like Abdullah tomorrow. So there were like, Moxley's an expert at this genre. You know, he was pulling it at the last second. Mm. They looked like they were trying to stab each other's brains out. It wasn't that thing where there's a bit of sleight of hand and they try and drag it across the forehead. You know what they were doing. They had so much trust in each other that they were just going full ham on each other's foreheads. Exhilarating, dangerous, very witty. Like very, very witty. Like the bird flips, using the fan. Like, Lance Archer is one of the funniest wrestlers, but he doesn't do rubbish patter. He can do all of this in the context of the physical match itself. I loved this match and I needed it to make me in a good mood, put me in a good mood after Dynamite.
Yeah.
And again, like one more thing, like it isn't just on WWE, like stupidly cruel to beat people in their hometown, because when was the last time anyone's ever written or read a list on whatculture.com? 10 times WWE made good on beating someone in the hometown or something. It just doesn't happen. not only was it a nice thing for Archer, not only was it a fundamentally really important thing to do to make him credible, because he can coast off this for the next 9 months of his career, right? But it's not just the mean-spirited aspect of WWE's stupid philosophy behind having guys wrestle in their hometown. Like, every real sport indicates that having the home advantage works massively. You've got a massive crowd behind you. Like, it's so logical that this would happen. Not just nice, not just really well done in a way that, oh, we can do whatever we want with Lance Archer because we've got this in the back pocket, so have him get beat to Miro. Like, oh, blah, 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 because this is going to get him back over. It's smart, it's just nice, and it makes all the goddamn sense in the world. Loved every single second of this on an intellectual and emotional level.
Yeah, I was a bit of a low guy on this one. There were still things I loved about it. It was that kind of match. I wasn't terribly invested. Find this formula a little bit plodding, if I'm honest. I'm consistent with that. I didn't love the Exploding Barbed Wire Death Match for its content, nor the original Moxley Omega match, not particularly Kenny and Sammy Callahan from the weekend. Though this, I thought, was more exciting, at least. I don't know if the crowd in size and scale helped it. Moxley worked it really well. Like, Archer was a lot of fun, and it was inventive, but Moxley's work in this was tremendous. Like, how he, just tweaked the dimmer switch a little bit to being a heel without betraying the babyface that he needs to be the rest of the time. Like, was hard, and he made it look easy. And I was, really, really impressed by that, which is not... Moxley does so much right that it's almost like you kind of forget to acknowledge the other stuff that he does really well as well. And it's the kind of stuff that he wouldn't have been tested on in WWE. So this was a little bit of a test that I thought he passed with flying colours. How to ever so slightly parlay this perfect babyface gimmick into being a heel when it makes sense within the context of a match. And I thought he nailed it. The big spots were really tremendous, though, to be fair. Like, the spots that made you a believer in Lance Archer were super effective. Things were looking pretty bleak for Moxley from the... I don't think that Moxley would have taken that chokeslam onto the chairs unless he was losing. I think he knows better to have included that. You needed to do something to him before dropping him in the barbed wire and trapping him. He needed to be physically wrecked as well as being trapped. And I think that's why that spot wasn't just brutal for brutal sake. I think it made a lot of sense as well. It showed, like, Archer's ability to still physically dominate and destroy somebody when he needed it most. And it has made Archer all over again. So it was an objective, regardless of, like, what you thought of it or how these matches work for you generally, like, an absolute objective success because the people went nuts for it. And Archer's good to go somehow, like, back from the brink, effectively. And Hikuleo comes in and he's massive. Like... I'm having a proper, mom reaction to him. Oh, he's tall, isn't he? Like, that would have been how my mom would have received every wrestler when I was a kid. He's tall.
And I was like, having my way.
Yeah, I'm going full at it, going full Art Donovan over his height. So, yeah, success. Regardless of my subjective takes, this was definitely a successful and a strong closing segment to, a Dynamite that wasn't strong all the way through.
Exactly, yeah. Great conclusion to the show. And now we move on to... Bloody hell, Fight for the Fallen. Hamlet, just give a nod to your brilliant tweet that I saw this morning regarding Fight for the Fallen and them not telling us how we have to pay for it.
Getting a lot of replies letting me know it's free to air. Thanks.
It's a literal reply, guys, man.
I did the thing this morning of like, oh, when have I ever been wrong about CM Punk? And partially, obviously, about Lance Archer. I think you'll find you're wrong about Otis cashing in. And yes, that's the joke. But yeah, good performance by Agent Ambrose here. And congratulations to Lance Archer, your new IWGP US champion for this week, at least. But let us know your thoughts on AEW Dynamite Fighter Fest Night 2 on Twitter at WhatCultureWWE. Watch, they can follow all three of us. You can follow Michael Hamlet at
Michael Hamlet.
Follow Michael Sidgwick at
M Sidgwick.
Follow me at Adam Wilborn. Follow us all at WhatCultureWWE. And make sure you subscribe to WhatCulture Wrestling, wherever you get your podcasts from, for daily wrestling podcasts. Quite a lot to discuss over the next few days, so probably worth subscribing if you haven't done so already. A lot of tidbits of news to maybe slightly dissect in the coming days, weeks, and let's be honest, probably months. But for now, this has been the AEW Dynamite Review. My thanks to the Dudley Boys. Thank you for joining us, and we will see you soon.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.